Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with Thomas Keels. His latest book, Forgotten Philadelphia, Lost Architecture of the Quaker City, is published in the fall. Jason Pfeiffer previews Ensemble at the Institute of Contemporary Art in Philadelphia. The exhibition features sound, sculptures, and installations. And Susan Lewis explores Philadelphia Zoo, the oldest zoological gardens in the country, and considers how its mission has expanded and changed along with contemporary concerns for the welfare of animals and the natural world. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Thomas Keels received an undergraduate degree in history, which he then, in his own words, ignored for 20 years while he forged a career in the commercial world. About 15 years ago, he began writing articles on local history for the Chestnut Hill local newspaper. These features ended up in a 2002 book on the history of that area called Chestnut Hill. The following year, Keels' Philadelphia Graveyards and Cemeteries was published. Thomas Keels' latest work, Forgotten Philadelphia, Lost Architecture of the Quaker City, to be published by Temple University Press in the coming weeks, tells the stories of three centuries of now vanished buildings in the Philadelphia region. Some of these disappeared due to lack of upkeep, others because of redundant usage, and some, like the Benjamin Rush birthplace in northeast Philadelphia, due to bureaucratic incompetence. Keels tells these stories in an informative and often entertaining style, and the book is an engaging read for both the studious and the merely curious. In 2006, a friend gave Thomas Keels a copy of Lost New York, Nathan Silver's much-acclaimed 1968 history of that city's many extant and extinct architectural treasures. This inspired Keels to begin researching Philadelphia's history of historic preservation. When Thomas Keels came into our studio earlier this week, I first asked him if he felt Philadelphia was more or less careful than other cities when it comes to preserving its architectural heritage.
Compared to many other cities, we are very good at historic preservation, thanks to Society Hill and to our historic buildings like Independence Hall. We do have one of the greatest collections of 18th century buildings in America. We are also, according to architectural historian George Thomas, one of the top five American cities when it comes to 19th century architecture. But this seems to give everybody the false impression that Philadelphia is preserved in amber, that we have never destroyed a single building ever. And in truth, we have destroyed as many great buildings by great architects as any world-class city.
Not a great boast. We're world-class at destroying our city.
better than most. But we really have destroyed an incredible number of buildings, some great, some not so great, but which had their own particular meaning and value. But since we were the center of American architecture for close to 150 years, people like Robert Smith, John Haviland, Benjamin Latrobe, leading up to Frank Furness, and then all the way up to, of course, Venturi and Scott Brown, have made Philadelphia their home. And many of these buildings were demolished over the course of the years. Part of it was due to Philadelphia's phenomenal growth. We grew from a city of a few thousand people to a city of nearly 2 million from 1750 to 1950. With that kind of growth and outward dynamic, it's inevitable the buildings are going to get destroyed.
There are some doozies in here, though. You mentioned Robert Smith, and I guess the building that most Philadelphians will be aware of that no longer exists, indeed there are no representations or photographs or paintings or anything, is Benjamin Franklin's home on Market Street.
That's correct. Part of it is because it was not a remarkable building. It was not a Mount Vernon. It was not a Monticello. Franklin was an urban man. He wanted to be close to Market Street. He wanted to be close to his printing office. And so his building was a comfortable but fairly modest 3.5-story brick house with outbuildings, dependencies, etc., in a courtyard just off of Market Street. He was very comfortable there.
And he had his bells and whistles there, which I guess would have made it interesting, all these extraction systems and lightning rods and various different sewage systems that were very novel for their time.
Evidently, it was cutting edge for the 1780s. He, of course, was an incredible inventor, so you did have lightning rods, but you also had little things like perhaps the first book hook in America. He had his library off of his bedroom, and he may have been the person who invented the device that the sort of mechanical arm that you use to pull books off a top shelf. Several visitors to his house remarked on what a unique and interesting invention this was. But after he died, the property went to his daughter and son-in-law, and then to their descendants, and by the early 1800s, Lower Market Street was very busy, very commercial, very built up. There was really no escaping the smells and the sounds of the market and the nearby commercial concerns. So they sold the house, and it was torn down, and Oriana Street was run through. As you said, when the Independence National Historical Park tried to restore the house in the years leading up to the bicentennial, they realized they had no good representation of the house. Evidently, there was one painting by James Thackera that had belonged to a Franklin descendant that had just disappeared around 1948. So although they were able to completely restore the buildings on Market Street, the printing office, mm-hmm. the post office, etc., they finally decided to turn the project over to Venturi and Rauch, who basically built the ghost houses that we see. They knew the general dimensions. They knew there was a chimney here. They knew the kitchen was here. But they put these wonderful white steel ghost structures up. And, of course, if you've been there, you know that you can look through these portholes and see the excavations, see the ruins of the foundations of the kitchen, of the privy pits and things like that. So you have a general idea of what the house was, but nobody really knows for sure.
This would be one of the more obvious buildings that no longer exists that many residents of this region will be aware of. Is there a particular building that we don't have general knowledge about that to you is a very significant loss to the region?
Yes. The Broad Street Station, which we do have knowledge of, there are thousands, millions of pictures of it, was the major Pennsylvania Railroad station in the city from 1881 to 1952. It was at Broad, on South Broad Street between Market and Filbert, right across from City Hall, basically on what is now Dilworth Plaza. And you look at it today, and unless you're very sympathetic to Victorian architecture, your first thought is, oh, this is where Gomez and Morticia go to catch their trains. It was an incredible building. The Pennsylvania Railroad was the largest, wealthiest corporation in America in the late 19th century. They used their wealth and political clout to build a Gothic station with a tall clock tower right at Filbert and Broad Street, and to put an elevated viaduct all the way from West Philadelphia, where 30th Street Station is today, running 2,000 feet all the way into the station, where it ran into four train sheds. So for the next 70 or 80 years, you had what became known as the Chinese Wall, their raised viaduct that had as many as 10 train tracks running trains through the middle of the city day and night.
And I'm guessing that was the reason it was demolished, because it was just taking up too much valuable real estate, or what was the logic behind getting rid of it? Was it a pretty building?
By the standards of the day, it was gorgeous. One thing I should add is that after they did the viaduct, within 2 years of building the building, the first building, they realized it was far too small. The concern was growing so quickly, so they hired Frank Furness to design a second station next to the original station that was about three times as big. They hired the Wilson brothers to design the largest train shed in the world. So it was an immense structure. It was really on the same scale as City Hall. And it was incredibly decorated. It was all red brick, terracotta. You had a well-known sculptor at the time called Carl Bitter, who did an allegorical series of sculptures. For instance, you had Time and Mortality, Two Beautiful Maidens, surrounding a clock over the main corner. You had the Spirit of Transportation, which is now a 30th Street station, showing man progressing from ox carts all the way to the automobile. It really mirrored Calder's allegorical sculptures on City Hall. And many people would look at it today and say, my God, what a Victorian pile. But by the standards of the time, it was incredibly beautiful. Unfortunately, we had 1893, the Columbian Exposition in Chicago, the White City. Everything had to be white, classical, pure, Beaux-Art. And suddenly, Broad Street Station and City Hall looked incredibly old-fashioned.
And we nearly lost City Hall in the process.
We nearly lost City Hall. Well, that was going to be the next stop. Once they tore down Broad Street Station, which didn't happen until 1952, we had the Depression and World War II, and that kept it around. The next stop was going to be City Hall. They were going to tear down everything except the tower, which they were going to streamline, make into this glorious Art Deco tower. Paul Philippe Cret had this wonderful design to make City Hall Square into City Hall Circle. It was going to be sort of like the Place de la Concorde in Paris, with just the tower in the center.
We talked about Franklin, but one, and I'm sure one that many people wouldn't be aware of, was the Benjamin Rush birthplace, which was in northeast Philadelphia and was demolished by accident.
By accident. Unfortunately, this is one of several cases of political disconnect that occurs in the book. The Benjamin Rush birthplace was this old stone farmhouse, nothing spectacular, but a beautiful old house where Benjamin Rush, doctor, signer of the Declaration of Independence, was born early in the 18th century. And he returned to the house many times during his life. He once wrote his friend John Adams about a visit to the house just before he died, seeing his father's initials carved in one of the doorposts. The house survived for many years after that. It was way up near the Byberry area of northeast Philadelphia, an area that stayed fairly rural until late. But by the 1960s, it had become very run down. Local historical groups were trying to save the house, make it into a shrine to Rush. It was supposedly protected by the Philadelphia Historical Commission. Unfortunately, nobody bothered telling the Department of Licenses and Inspection, who one day in the 1960s knocked it down. It was sort of like, oops, sorry about that. They did save most of the pieces. They were put in storage at the old Byberry Hospital. And I believe that a citizens group is now trying to raise money to have the house restored in some aspect. I have no idea how much of it actually survived.
And what's happened to the land that it existed on?
It is now part of a local park, I believe. I'm not sure if it's part of Benjamin Rush Park, which is way up in the northeastern end of the city, but I believe that the land is still open. Whether or not they would build it on that land or build it in a more protected environment, I don't know.
But the potential is possibly still there for this building to exist again in its original location.
Possible, yes. Probable, no.
Thomas Keels, his latest work, Forgotten Philadelphia, Lost Architecture of the Quaker City, is published by Temple University Press this fall.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
The Institute of Contemporary Art in Philadelphia opens its fall exhibitions this week. The new season includes images by local photographer Eileen Neff, an installation from artist Jay Hikes, and Ensemble. This is an unusual exhibition, even for a contemporary art venue prone to experimentation. It's a sound art show, made up of sculptures and installations selected primarily for the sounds they make, as WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports.
The Ensemble exhibit inaugurates the guest curator program at the Institute of Contemporary Art. As opposed to assembling new exhibits through the more traditional route with an in-house curator, the new initiative is designed to bring outside viewpoints to the museum. As ICA director Claudia Gould and her staff discussed who to invite, she says they considered art historians, freelance curators.
And then we said, why not an artist? We're an institution that focuses very artist-centric. So why not go to the source of what we show here and what we support?
Gould says because artists are mainly interested in showing their own work, the ICA looked for a creator who was generous, who could go outside him or herself to put together a group of works from others. In their view, Christian Marclay fit the bill. A composer of experimental music, a DJ, and a visual artist, Marclay had never curated a visual exhibition before, but he proposed the idea of a show based on live, non-amplified sound. It was the sort of novel approach that Claudia Gould had in mind.
None of us would have thought of this. And so that's the idea, is to bring something here that we as curators would never be able to think of or conjure up, is to sort of expand our own horizons and also the audience of Philadelphia to different kinds of things.
In putting together the ensemble exhibition, Christian Marclay didn't really see his role to be that of a curator. Instead, he describes himself as a collage artist.
I've always been interested in this idea of collecting things and using things that exist out there in the world. I'm not, you know, even though I make sculptures, I don't carve them out of stone or cast them in bronze. I'm more interested in what's around me. And this idea of putting this show together actually came out of probably that kind of practice where I'm more of a collagist, finding things, putting them together, finding interesting juxtapositions and relationship between objects. And in this case, I was more interested in the sound that these works could produce and how they would coexist in the same space.
Featuring the work of about 30 artists, Ensemble spans the spectrum of sounds, from an assortment of music boxes to bells to hundreds of shells hanging on string to a ball rolling downward on a series of metal tracks. One exhibit piece, appropriately titled The Alarming Trash Can, is an innocent-looking, mundane metal garbage bin. But lift the can cover, and you'll be in for a jolt. Angela White's exhibit piece, called Three Turntables and Michael Jackson, consisting of three record players that cause shards of hanging ceramic pieces to collide with one another, is situated close to the alarming trash can, which doesn't bother White.
When I'm working in my studio, I'm like right behind the fire station, so I hear this like all of a sudden I'm working and listening, and then there's this huge fire truck that's like rolling down the street and making these huge sounds. So I'm like, I hear live fire engine sounds with my piece, so it's kind of interesting being right next to the piece that sounds like a big sire. Yeah, I feel at home.
White says just as sounds constantly overlap in everyday life, it seems natural that these exhibit sounds would coexist as well. And this is indeed one of the core ideas of this exhibition. All the different sounds of the sculptures and installations should overlap and mix. Christian Marclay says his DJ experiences informed his work of piecing together this new ICA show.
I've been DJing since the late 70s, so that's sort of how I traditionally make sounds. Why do I select some records to mix together? Because I feel like they can work together and create something else. It is very much about finding sounds and putting them together to create new compositions.
Creating artistic compositions with sound is, of course, nothing new. But just as there are many different perspectives as to what constitutes visual art, the question of when sound becomes art is also difficult to define. Yet Christian Marclay doesn't dwell too long on such heady matters and is more interested in creating greater awareness of the sounds around us.
How suddenly if you create an environment in which you're forced to listen, then your attention is going to be very different than if you're just walking down the street thinking I'm late for this meeting. In the art context of a museum or a gallery, one tends to want to isolate that sound and give it this kind of perfect frame where nothing is going to come and disturb it. And to me, that's what I'm reacting against. I don't want that artificial space. I'm interested in life, and art should be life, and it is life.
With motion sensors that activate various exhibit pieces and other works meant to produce sound at the touch of a visitor, Christian Marclay says the pieces that fill the gallery space will continually relate in new ways.
Hopefully, you know, every time you walk through the space, you'll hear different connections, different sounds interacting together, and no two visits should be the same.
To underline this dynamic of the exhibit, Marclay has invited musicians and performers to come throughout the duration of the show to take part in the exhibition, presenting their work and reacting to the sounds they hear from the sculptures and installations. The performances and exhibit pieces will be recorded and eventually released on CD.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. Ensemble opens at the Institute of Contemporary Art on 36th and Sansom Streets in Philadelphia on Friday and runs through December 16th. In an age of technology-driven entertainment options, from big-screen TVs to video arcades to the latest in digital sound and light shows, one of the most visited family attractions in the Philadelphia area still relies on the natural world for its appeal. But the Philadelphia Zoo's mission is not simply entertainment. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis looks at how the zoo has changed with the times in its approach to its animals, its visitors, and the vanishing wild.
In 1859, the charter of the Zoological Society of Philadelphia was signed, the first of its kind in the nation. Despite its early start, the Civil War intervened, and the zoo gates didn't open to the public until July 1, 1874, when the city was getting ready for the country's centennial celebration. Rachel DeCaro, who manages the zoo's archives, says the people behind the zoo were thinking in international and scientific terms.
This society wanted to do more of what they had in Europe, a zoo with more of a purpose than just caging animals and looking at them. The nutrition program at the zoo was the first of its type. The pathology program was the first of its type in the entire world.
The zoo was located on the outskirts of the city, in what must have seemed an ideal garden setting. Already on the property was Solitude, the neoclassical home of William Penn's grandson, John Penn. Frank Furness designed the Victorian gates and gatehouses. The trip from the city was made by streetcars, horse and carriage, or steamboat down the Schuylkill River.
At that time, it was really to be a refuge away from the city, sort of an oasis.
Vikram Dewan is the president of the Philadelphia Zoo.
Today, the city is all around us. We are as much a part of the city and integrated into the fabric of the city as almost anything else.
It still has a garden feel, but that of a city garden, where the buzzing of airplanes overhead, the roar of leaf blowers on the ground, and the hum of city traffic on the nearby expressway mingle with the vocalizing of lions, monkeys, and exotic parrots. Not to mention all the young humans.
The birdhouse or the giraffes and the monkeys. Those are my three favorites.
Big Cat Falls, Bear Country, and the reptiles.
Providing a look at animals from around the world is still the zoo's biggest draw. Public education about those animals is a second goal, one that Director of Education Kathy Wagner says has been around since the beginning.
The Philadelphia Zoo's charter back in 1859 actually talks about the Philadelphia Zoo as being a place for public education and recreation. I think it really hasn't been until the last 20 or 30 years that we've really come to actualize that education mission and make it real in terms of multiple school programs, members programs, opportunities for families to become engaged.
Also in the last 30 years, a third purpose, conservation, became a driving force in the mission of zoos. People working with animals in zoos and the wild realized that human intervention was causing species to become extinct. And human intervention could, in some cases, save them. Vice President of Animal Programs Andrew Baker says the Philadelphia Zoo was involved in a 1980s rescue after a snake from one Pacific island stowed away on a ship and came onto land at Guam.
And basically the snake consumed all the land-based birds on Guam. And there was sort of a last-ditch rescue effort, and two species were successfully brought off the island, the Guam rail and the Guam Micronesian kingfisher. And they're alive only because we rescued the last few and started captive breeding programs. The Philadelphia Zoo has been leading the kingfisher captive breeding program for a number of years. We started out with only 20. We're now up over 100.
After rescue, the species is reintroduced to its native environment. But saving a species through captive breeding, or in zoo lingo, operating as an ark, is a last resort, says Baker. The zoo is one of 214 accredited by the Association of Zoos and Aquariums.
So we're not looking at necessarily what's best for our zoo or what's best for the Omaha Zoo or what's best for the Bronx Zoo. It's really what's best for the entire population.
As an example, the zoo's care of the Amur tiger and her cubs in the exhibit Big Cat Falls is part of a national program. President Vikram Dewan says the tigers create awareness about programs in the wild.
There's probably nothing that's cuter than seeing three tiger cubs. But what we hope people are leaving with is more than that, an understanding that there are only 400 Amur tigers left in the world, and that they, through irresponsible practices that we human beings have had around poaching, illegal hunting, encroaching on habitat and the like. What we have done in turn is really taken a magnificent species and decimated it. And so what we're hoping that people learn is that there is a stewardship responsibility that comes from that.
Duan says the zoo partners with others in international conservation efforts, providing both financial and people resources. People like Andrew Baker, who earned his PhD in animal behavior studying the golden lion tamarins.
And I've continued to study them in the wild and work on a conservation project. Multiple staff have gone down with me to help study them, track their demography, understand the threats to them in the wild.
The zoo's approach to animals in captivity is to put them in environments where they'll thrive. As examples, shifting tunnels in the back of Big Cat Falls enable lions and tigers to take turns roaming in each other's spaces. In the primate reserve, the perching, or tree-like climbing structures, are movable and changed to provide variety. Two primates that would never meet in the wild, an orangutan and a white-handed gibbon, are housed together because they seem to enjoy each other's company. And on the day we visit, a purple plastic ride-on toy, probably not common in the jungle, sits in the exhibit of the Duke Langer, a monkey native to Vietnam. Erin McCool is the public programs coordinator.
The goal of all of our enrichment programs here at the zoo is to enable the animals to act sort of as they would in the wild. You notice they probably don't see a big, huge purple toy in the wild, but if it encourages them to do the things that they would in the wild, to manipulate items, to forage for their food, that means that we're doing the right thing.
Outdoors, near a visitor path, golden lion tamarins, small monkeys with golden fur and manes around their faces, play in the trees outside a large cage in the middle of a wooded patch of land, under the watchful eyes of several zoo employees. Native to Brazil, during the day the animals free range, meaning go wherever they want. Mostly golden lion tamarins are family-oriented and tend to be home buddies, with one exception.
As the babies grow up to be adolescents, they tend to venture a little bit further from the group. Mom tamarin will call, and you know the other tamarins will call to them, so you'll hear lots of noise, and they're incredibly loud. They almost sound like birds.
One destination of adolescent tamarins is a nearby statue of a gorilla who once lived at the zoo. The zoo has over 40 sculptures accenting its gardens. The dying lioness, created for the Centennial Exhibition, has sat outside the main gates since 1876. It is said to symbolize the need for animal preservation. While the zoo has over 1,300 animals from all over the world, it does not have, or not for long, elephants. Andrew Baker says losing the elephants is a consequence of concern about what animals need, as well as the ever-present challenge of funding.
As our understanding of animals and our own internal expectations change, we've been changing the environments for almost every animal here at the zoo. We had on the books a plan for a brand new elephant facility at the south end of the zoo, multi-acre, much more flexible, larger and more creative environment for the elephants. Unfortunately, we have not been successful at the fundraising piece for that.
Also, confinement to 42 acres necessarily limits the kind of open-air space the zoo can devote to animal habitats.
No, we're never going to have a huge collection of large hoofstock. Antelope, deer, wild goats. But I think what we offer is an intimate experience where people can really make connections with animals and with each other.
So if you come in with your family or friends on a Sunday afternoon, you might be greeted at the entrance with someone with maybe one of our Madagascar hissing cockroaches. So that's an educational experience that you might not expect.
We use the fact that people are able to get whisker close to animals, that moves them to being able to want to learn more about the planet that, for which we have responsibility.
And this interaction between people and animals is perhaps the most effective way of accomplishing three key goals of the Philadelphia Zoo: public education, recreation, and conservation of animals and the world around us.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. And that's our program for this week. Our thanks to Jill Katz, Kirsten Wolfe, and Gary Kramer. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.